Good morning, Connecticut, to our friends across the Sound. It's Super Bowl Sunday, and I'm John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we're going to be opening up our Super Bowl Sunday show talking about Connecticut's Small Business Development Center, or SBDC, a statewide initiative that can help quarterback small businesses to greater success with game-changing support, guidance, and resources. Then we're going to turn to the subject of pediatric attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, with a representative from Connecticut's Child Health and Development Institute, which was tapped as one of the few organizations across the country to pilot a program helping pediatricians recognize and respond to children exhibiting symptoms of ADHD so they can better assist these children and their families. And since you're probably getting ready to prep for your big Super Bowl party, we're going to close with a 27-year veteran food safety expert from the USDA about keeping you and your guests safe from foodborne illness so everyone can enjoy the big game today. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. Hey, are you a cyclist or just love bikes? The North American Handmade Bicycle Show, the world's largest show for custom-built bicycles, is gearing up for its 2018 exhibit taking place in Hartford, February 16th to 18th at the Connecticut Convention Center. This annual three-day event changes venues every year, and it's being held in New England for the very first time in its 14-year history. The show will feature a vibrant collection of handmade bicycles from a wide array of exhibitors, including international companies hailing from Russia, UK, Italy, Australia, Ireland, and Canada, giving attendees the chance to see brands they might not otherwise ever see. For more information about the North American Handmade Bicycle Show, visit NAHBS.com. Well, as we sort of said in the introduction, trying to steer away from but finding it impossible to avoid football and Super Bowl puns, it's been way too long since we had a representative of the Small Business Development Center system on the award-winning For the People, and I'm so glad to welcome back Joseph Ercolano, who is the Associate State Director for the Small Business Development Center here today. Excuse the pun, but these guys really are in place to help small business owners and small businesses throughout the state of Connecticut really up their game when it comes to their operations, their personnel, their way of doing business, access to all kinds of resources and funding. We're going to find out all about it. But I will tell you that the SBDC here in Connecticut does provide no-cost advising services to both prospective and existing business owners to help them start or expand their businesses. They're funded through a cooperative agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration, or SBA, the Connecticut Department of Economic and Community Development, who's a regular fixture here on our program, and the University of Connecticut. We won't steal all of Mr. Ercolano's thunder, and there's a lot more information for him to provide us about the nuts and bolts of the SBDC here in Connecticut and how it works and how it can serve you, so we'll get right into it. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning.
Happy to be here, John. Thank you.
So quickly, just a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in the SBDC here in Connecticut.
Oh, sure. I've been interested and involved in economic and community development for a number of years. I also have some corporate background experience. And this opportunity opened up for me 4 years ago when we built a whole new SBDC team at the University of Connecticut. The SBDC had been in Connecticut for 35 years. At UConn, and then it went over to the Central Connecticut State U location in New Britain, and then back at UConn 4 years ago. So we hired a whole new team, have a lot of great talent in our advising team and our advisors and supportive services. And it was just a perfect fit for, you know, trying to help develop businesses, jobs, and growth in our state. Mm.
And just to continue to evidence the power of networking, I mean, it was just earlier this week that I happened to be at a ribbon cutting ceremony for a small business in northern Fairfield County when I ran across a great fellow named Nelson who gave me his business card and we got to talking. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Oh, a small business development center. You guys haven't been on my show for a long, long time." And he said, "Oh, well, give me a call and we'll try to do it." And, you know, probably as evidence to how quickly you respond to small businesses, boom, here you are just a few days later, ready to do the program. So kudos to Nelson for making that contact. I see his picture here on your website. So I just wanted to thank him publicly for his assistance in getting us back together again. It's been way too long. So you said you're based up at UConn, but explain to the folks where they can find an SBDC liaison or representative near where their business might be located.
Well, actually, the way we would like people to find us is through our website. We'd mm-hmm. like people to register for advising, which is free, and it's confidential, and there's no strings attached whatsoever. And they could then be contacted if they register through our website. They'll be contacted by an advisor in their area. And there are 12 of our advisors around the state, every major city, and some of those advisors have multiple offices. Mm. So you might meet with your advisor at a chamber of commerce, or you might meet with them at a local town hall, mm-hmm. Economic development office, or maybe it's, you know, a coffee shop or a restaurant, depending on what the client wants and prefers. We will come to the client. Most of the time, we'll work something out that's convenient to both the advisor and the client. But the quickest way to get us is to go to our website, ctsbdc.com, click on the tab that says Business Advising, and then a button that says Register for Advising, and you're on your way.
Excellent. So it's not a situation where people can just say, "Oh, I've got a couple hours after I go to the bank. I'm just going to walk in and, you know, it's not counter service, so to speak. It is
More
of a customized one-on-one experience."
That problem with that approach, John, is that, you know, a lot of times our advisors are out working with a client somewhere. So they're not there. Yeah.
Well, the exciting thing is about SBDC is we don't want people who are out there who are owner operators or one man shows or who are creative thinking entrepreneurs that the Small Business Development Center may not be for them. You work, as we said in the intro, with people who even have just a glimmer of an inspiration and the entrepreneurial attitude that you may recognize can make it happen.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we do rely heavily on some of our partner organizations to help people because, you know, in some instances, we may not be the right assistance that they need at that point in time. Mm-hmm. So we'll, for example, refer a lot of folks to SCORE. And SCORE has a very active presence in Connecticut. I think it's the most active state around in the country for SCORE counselors and workshops, etc. And there's a workshop all the time that someone can go to and begin to test for themselves, is this where I want to head? Do I want to go down the path of owning a business? If they've got a particular type of need that maybe we can help answer, should they register as a LLC, a limited liability corp, or a sole proprietorship, or a C corp, we can help with those questions over the phone. And maybe they don't really need to register for services that directly. Then, of course, we've got other partners who may offer direct technical assistance, organizations like Constep or CERC that maybe we're not equipped to provide. We're always looking to make a warm handoff so the client can feel like they don't have to make 17 phone calls to get what they really need. We'll try to help them avoid having to do that.
Excellent. It's also really exciting to see that you have some particular expertise if you're approached by veterans, women's, and minority entrepreneurs. But it's also pleasantly shocking to see how young some of your clients have been.
You're right, exactly. We have, 16-year-old clients, and we have 68-year-old clients. It's all over the map. The baby boomers are still a major force in creating businesses in our country. But having said that, we do encourage and appreciate the opportunity to work with local partners who reach a younger population, and whether it be high school, community college, four-year institutions. We have folks that have been engaged at universities all around the state, not just UConn. We've worked in programs at Fairfield U, University of Bridgeport, Western Connecticut State University, Southern, some of the community colleges, Housatonic and Aspetuck and Manchester Community. Mm. We've been, we try to be where the need is and where people express a desire to work with us. We're there if we can be.
Excellent. Folks, if you just tuned in here, Super Bowl Sunday, we're going to help you score a touchdown or better, win the game if you're a small business person. Joseph Ercolano is with us. He is the Associate State Director for the Small Business Development Centers here in Connecticut. Get started with a relationship with SBDC at ctsbdc.com. And one of their representatives can qualify you for assistance or referral to help you whether you're have a glimmer of an idea that may end up being a career, or you're an established business looking to take it to the next level. These programs remain one of the nation's largest small business assistance initiatives in the federal government system, with a proven track record that's almost 35 years strong. So they've got the experience to make it happen for you. And as you're hearing from Joe, if you were with us over the past few minutes, Connecticut has a really robust network incorporating the SBDC, but many other organizations like SCORE to provide help. So you're in a good state and a good place to succeed with all these great supports. So, Joe, let's switch gears and talk about and drill in a little bit more to the range of services that you provide. And what are the most prevalent types of assistance that people are looking for?
I would say by far people come to us looking for help to access capital for growth and expansion. And so what we do is to prepare them for that conversation they need to have with a lender or an investor. So we'll do that by doing some deep dive analysis of their financial statements and their financial situation. We'll talk about their projected revenue or their projected expenses, and help them be able to demonstrate clearly and concisely to a lender that they can afford to pay back a loan they might ask for. It might be a working capital loan. It might be loans to finance acquisition of equipment or real estate. As long as it's tied to a business, we can help them. And just as an example, John, last year our clients were able to raise $54 million in finance, either loan or investment for their businesses. So we can point to that as an indication of the type of thing we help the client work for, work toward. We're really trying to help them achieve the milestones they're trying to achieve.
Okay. Well, the last time I kind of went and looked it up, kind of alarming statistic was that about one out of every two small businesses or businesses that start up in the United States tend to fail or go out of business within a year or so. I don't know if that is the case here in Connecticut or not, but I'm more interested in finding out from your perspective, how much greater is the challenge or the burden on an individual who is getting started versus a business that kind of may have started and is kind of chugging along, a month in the red, a month in the black, a month very close to the line on either side, and they really want to kind of kick it up to that next level? Let's talk about new startups and new businesses. What are the range of challenges or hurdles that they have to clear in order to set a path toward more likely success?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the first thing that new startups need to do is to really be clear in their minds and on paper, because they have to sometimes share this with others, what their business model is, how they will make money, who are their customers, what do they, how do they expect to reach those customers, and what kind of revenue do they truly anticipate bringing in the door in year one. Year one is critical because year one establishes both to themselves and to others that this is a viable, sustainable business. Sometimes it might take 2 years to prove or disprove that, but you know, year one is going to be where you begin to build that traction. The challenge for those startups, in addition to be able to clarify their business model, is to finance it. And we have a lot of folks who come to us who are unfortunately not in a position to self-finance to get the doors open and begin to sell something. So it becomes difficult to find people who are willing to take a risk and hand someone money to start up and get the, you know, get some initial sales going. There are programs that will offer some low-cost loans, and there's there are programs that will be available for folks who are not bankable, if I can use that term in the traditional sense, go into a commercial bank. But, you know, they, even those programs are looking for a year, minimum of a year of established business bringing in revenue, bringing in money through the door. So those are the biggest challenges that we see, and we do our best to try to, you know, work through the challenges we keep those as best we can. But there's no easy answers, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. And I think probably one of the saddest things for me, aside from hearing of someone either that I know directly, friend of a friend, someone in the community who's tried to start a business and it has not worked out, is that, you know, they saw something on the internet or they went to a seminar at a hotel or something, and they were convinced that they should go out there and line up a few credit cards and lines of credit and max those credit cards out with cash advances to use that as their investment in themselves, because you know, that's really the only way to get started. Any words of wisdom to individuals who are contemplating that means of funding their startup?
Well, it's not one of those don't ever do it kind of answers. It's really build confidence in your ability to pay yourself back by taking it slowly, and don't over invest in things that really don't help you test your product assumption. So, you know, one of the great examples that we use in some of our workshops is the story of Zappos, where the gentleman who started Zappos back in the late 90s wasn't sure people would buy shoes online. But instead of building a warehouse and stocking it with thousands of pairs of shoes, he simply went down the street to a local, couple of local shoe stores and said, I'd like to take a picture of these shoes. If I sell them online, I'll come back and buy them from you. And that's what he did. Mm. And he proved to himself that, yes, there is a market to sell shoes online. It was a low-cost investment, not a lot of overhead. He still had to begin to build out a website and an ordering system and a shopping cart on his website, and he had to deal with customer service and customer returns. Mm. But he was able to take that step by step and not have to come up with, you know, $2 million of initial investment. I don't know what his initial investment was, but it was certainly, you know, a small fraction of that.
And certainly,
but we try to give that kind of advice of, you know, if you are going to self-finance, see if you can avoid jumping in with both feet,
not to pick up on that about following in his footsteps, but there has certainly been a million other online clothing and accessory retailers that have followed that formula and saw some success as well. Before we have to let you go, Joe Ercolano, tell me. I mean, the other exciting thing about the Small Business Development Center is that it partners with the power of UConn. Just before we close, tell us where UConn fits into your program.
Well, it's exciting to be part of UConn. There's so much going on in the area of business and big and analytics and digital media. And, you know, we are able to tap into very knowledgeable people, understand, you know, how we can help them sometimes bring their research to a commercial setting. And we've worked with everything from professors to graduate students who work directly with our clients on an internship basis. We can't do that for every client, unfortunately, but we've been able to begin to assist in ways we never thought we could by linking our clients to very talented, very experienced grad students and even some undergrads who bring some new perspective or maybe bring some just manpower to the table that our clients can't provide on their own. So we're excited about UConn. It's a real great, great opportunity for us to bring that to the community and to give back to the school as well.
Right, and it gives the business a little bit of sense of what how their creation or invention or idea is perceived by a younger demographic market equipped with the educational and practical expertise to kind of give them information through the eyes of someone they might not otherwise be able to get it from, which is highly valuable and sought after by any business from the big global conglomerates on down to the little in-home entrepreneurial effort. So fantastic. Yeah. Great to talk to you. We could go on for a much longer time, and I hope we get a chance to do that again soon because it's been too long since the SBDC has been a guest on the show. Joseph Arcolano, sure. Great to make your acquaintance. He's Associate State Director of the Connecticut Small Business Development Centers, providing no-cost advising services to both prospective and existing business owners from teens to octogenarians almost to help them start or expand their businesses. CTSBDC.com. CTSBDC.com is where it all starts for you, whether you're just coming up with an idea or you're an existing business that's ready to help. Joe, great to meet you and make your acquaintance. Thank you for being with us this morning and have a great Super Bowl. All right. Well, it's not alphabet soup, but we've got CHDI on the line to talk about ADHD this morning. So as we said in the introduction, a very, very important and I guess sometimes very misunderstood subject, or at least a little challenging to identify even with pediatricians. So we were so pleased when a week or so ago we received notification that our friends at the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut, who are regular guests on our program, we check in with them at least a couple of times a year, released their latest report about supporting pediatric primary care practices in addressing ADHD, which if I have this right, is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Is that right? Is that right, Susan?
Yes.
Good. Susan McCary's on the line. She's a senior associate for health initiatives at CHDI. She coordinates work related to the integration of health and mental health care in settings where young children are served, primarily in pediatric practices and in early care and education sites. So we've got the right person on the line to talk about this really, really important report. And the most exciting thing that I gathered from this, Susan, is that it's grant supported, and not only grant supported, but your organization is just one of a very small handful across the country that won this grant to do the work you're doing.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about the work up to this. Is ADHD and the overlap with pediatric care been on your radar before you learned about the grant and got the idea to develop a report?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we've been working with pediatric primary care providers for a very long time, more than 10 years on a variety of health topics. So this is one of the health topics that we've been waiting to sort of jump on and help pediatricians with screening children for ADHD.
Mm-hmm. So give us the backstory. There was a kind of a national protocol that was established some years back?
Yes, there was. In, I believe, 2001, the first guideline, the clinical practice guidelines for the identification of ADHD came out by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And since then, they've updated their guidelines. In 2011 was the most recent guideline. Mm-hmm. These are national best practices. And This particular one is for the diagnosis, evaluation, and treatment of ADHD in children and adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
And the guideline covers six key action statements. So the first one is initiating an evaluation for ADHD. The second one is making a diagnosis that includes information from several sources. So, for example, a child's parents, teachers, or other school and mental health clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
The third statement is an assessment for other emotional, developmental, and physical conditions that might coexist with ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And also recognizing that ADHD is really a chronic health condition, and therefore applying the principles of family-centered care and care coordination with schools and family support services. And the last two are initiating age-appropriate treatment for ADHD as warranted. So, for example, for younger children, their treatment may be just behavioral interventions. For older children, it would be behavioral interventions, counseling, and medication. And finally, the last piece in all of this is the medication itself, when it's recommended,
mm-hmm.
Just adjusting the doses of medication for maximum benefit and little adverse effect. So again, this is a national clinical guidelines, and for this particular project, the AAP, in collaboration with the Pfizer Independent Grants for Learning and Change, they put out an RFP nationally looking for organizations that could develop and test innovative ways to help pediatric primary care practices implement some or all of the guidelines.
Hmm. So as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder kind of
yeah.
came into its own, and it started kind of being, and ADHD started kind of being part of the national language, or the kind of, you know, more widespread and known about at the national level 15 or 20 years ago, I think, is when I started really kind of hearing ADHD more,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to ADD or other similar disorders. Were pediatricians sort of lagging behind in terms of their involvement in the treatment protocol? Was this something that kind of was championed and supported by behavioral specialists and school psychologists and things like that?
Right. Well, I wouldn't say they were lagging behind as much as the clinical guidelines came out, and sometimes it takes a while from the publication of the guidelines
yep.
to actually implementing them.
Yes.
Implementing them fully takes a while for any practice.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a long time. And now with the current guidelines, there's more to do. They've added more steps. So I think pediatric primary care is a really great starting point for
sure.
any family that has concerns.
Yeah.
They can definitely go to behavioral health counseling for
mm-hmm.
sure, but the pediatric primary care practice and provider, they are they're a prime place.
ADHD.
See the patients a lot, and they have well child visits, they have a rapport with the families,
yeah.
and they can sort of guide the families along.
Yeah. So maybe ADHD just wasn't as amplified on the radar, or the lack of integrating and keeping up with upgrades in these guidelines was the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, having referral sources is a really big issue as well. Pediatricians can definitely counsel in their practice. They can do some counseling for ADHD. But having a referral source that is local and doesn't have a long waiting list, that's a problem for many conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think giving the pediatricians the tools to be able to do that in their practice would be a huge help for them and their families.
Excellent. Before we take a quick break, folks, we're on the line with Susan McCary. She's a Master of Public Health and a Senior Associate for Health Initiatives at the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut. They are a spectacular resource for us here at the award-winning For the People. We like to visit with them at least a couple of times a year. They're constantly cranking out these very, very important reports, all toward taking better care of Connecticut Connecticut's children. Susan, before we take a break, get down to the very basic. How many children have ADHD, just give us a little bit of an idea of how the behaviors of ADHD manifest in these children.
Sure. So about 1 in 10 parents of children ages 4 to 17 in Connecticut and nationally, report that their child has been diagnosed with ADHD. So I would say nationally about 11% of children 4 to 17 years of age, so that's about 6.4 million children, have ever been diagnosed with ADHD, according to parent reports from a national survey of children's health. So in Connecticut, again, approximately 10% of children have ever been diagnosed with ADHD. So if left untreated, children with ADHD may have trouble focusing or controlling impulsive behaviors, which can subsequently cause problems at school, at home, or relationships with peers. About half of them are at risk for a mood disorder. So, for example, depression, that's one example. Other disorders can occur in about half of children who are untreated. But really, when they become treated, most of those, when we treat the ADHD and the coexisting conditions, they have very successful outcomes.
Excellent. Well, yeah. We're going to come back and talk about a little more about the pilot project and the initial results, how CHDI is helping pediatricians address ADHD in Connecticut, and some of the best practices that they should be adhering to based on these upgraded guidelines. We'll be back with Susan McCary to talk more about their work with Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, ADHD. She is with the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut. Folks, stick with us. We'll be back to pick up on this conversation in just a moment. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to our Super Bowl Sunday edition of the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Connecticut State Department of Education is now accepting applications for its 2018 Summer Food Service Program. The program coordinates the local administration of summer food service, which is funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and serves as the summer extension of the National School Lunch and Breakfast Programs that provide meals for students during the school year. If children are to receive a nutritious meal during the summer break, the assistance of local organizations is critical, and qualified local sponsoring organizations must be identified to provide these meals. Eligible sponsor organizations are needed across the state, but especially in the municipalities of Bristol, Chaplin, Clinton, East Windsor, Enfield, Griswold, Hamden, Ledyard, Milford, Plainville, Plymouth, Shelton, Sprague, Sterling, and Wallingford. If you'd like to find out how to apply for the Summer Food Service Program, go to sde.ct.gov. That's sde.ct.gov. Folks, thanks for sticking with us. We're talking about a very important issue when it comes to Connecticut's children, as you heard many, many of them here in Connecticut suffer from or have already been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. And we heard from our guest, Susan McCary, who's a senior associate for health initiatives at the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut, how gone untreated ADHD can kind of lead into myriad other mood and behavioral issues into adolescence and adulthood. So, Susan, once again, thanks for being with us. First of all, in terms of the pilot project, kind of give us the nuts and bolts of that and some of the initial results now, I guess since July this has been going on?
Correct. Actually, since August.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's been really exciting. As you probably know, pediatricians are increasingly expected to go beyond the physical needs of their patients by identifying behavioral and other concerns in order to help their patients achieve improved health, educational, and social outcomes. So we're excited because we're helping providers to better implement the AAP national guidelines that I spoke about earlier.
Yep.
And again, it's a one-year pilot project. And the project is a wonderful collaboration with the Connecticut Family Support Network, the Practice Quality Improvement Program, which is at the Office for Community Child Health at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. Mm-hmm. And we also have clinical expertise from the Yale Child Study Center and other pediatricians that are helping us with this project. So it's been a really nice statewide collaboration. So the project is focused on supporting pediatric primary care practices in, one, identifying and diagnosing ADHD among children, two, assessing for coexisting conditions, again, such as depression or anxiety that might occur with ADHD, and three, connecting families to treatment. So for children who've been diagnosed with ADHD, we want to connect them and their families to treatment, including behavioral counseling, either by the primary care physician or a referral to an outside source, and also connect them with family support services, such as the Connecticut Family Support Network.
Mm. And now just 6 months into this one-year pilot, I understand you are uplifted by some of the outcomes that you're seeing already.
Yes, we are. We are. So to date, we've trained 129 pediatric primary care providers. That's across 10 practices in Connecticut. They've been enrolled in this pilot project. We've trained them through CHDI's EPIC program, which stands for Educating Practices in Communities. And we're training them to implement the guideline, again, for early identification and diagnosis of ADHD, for assessment of coexisting conditions, and connecting families to treatment. Mm-hmm. The practices also conduct monthly evaluations of their progress toward improving care for children with ADHD. They use a data-driven quality improvement approach to bring about improvements in care. Mm-hmm. So to date, our results from a survey that providers complete after they've been trained, we have about 65 providers that have completed the survey. They indicate that about 90% of providers found the information presented to be very valuable, and 90% intend to use the information presented in the training. So about half of the practices also reported that they're already screening for ADHD and coexisting conditions using a validated instrument, and about half of the practices are further assessing for ADHD among children who screen positive for attention concerns on the instrument. So we're really excited, and we are actually going to be enrolling a couple more practices as well as time goes on. So it's been really exciting.
Is there some prospect of a renewal or an expansion of the pilot after the close of the one-year grant?
Yeah, absolutely. Pending the results, which again look promising so far, we're going to offer the training module, the EPIC training module, and the monthly evaluations for widespread distribution to other practices in Connecticut. And the training is expected to become available to all pediatric sites in Connecticut around the fall, like September, probably September, October. So so I think it'll be very valuable to bring this to the rest of Connecticut.
Excellent. Well, for the benefit, let's switch gears and talk directly to the parents and caregivers. What are a couple of the most important best practices pediatricians should be adhering to from the guide?
I would say to screen for and identify and diagnose ADHD among children, and then treat them and communicate with their school as well. We want to make sure that there's a school pediatric partnership, mm-hmm. And then also to include parents in the care plan for the children. And parents can, again, if they have a concern, they can go to their pediatrician. That's a good place to start. If families need support, they can also contact the Connecticut Family Support Network at www.ctfsn.org. Mm-hmm. They can call 211 to find local support services, and they can always check out the kidsmentalhealthinfo.com. That's a good place to go as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Earlier on in the first part of the segment, you talked a little bit about, the number of, points or standards. One of them was related to those who may be deemed to do best with medication, mm-hmm. and finding that right formula of medication. We hear so often in situations, even with fairly young children on up through teens and maybe even the early 20s, that the way a lot of these medications make them feel makes them not want to take them. Can you speak to that point at all?
Well, I have heard that as well, anecdotally from different physicians, that they don't want to take them. The point of this project does not include the medication component of this. The medication is part of the training that we offer. We don't focus on that. We suggest that physicians, if they're comfortable to medicate, if they're not, then seek support to do that. But we have heard that, and I think that my perspective is that happens not only with ADHD, but possibly other medications for other conditions as well. So I don't think it's just specifically for ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I would say, you know, for the physicians that we work with, again, we tell them to get support where they can and when they need it. And if they feel comfortable, they can prescribe.
And for families and caregivers who are coping with a child who is either diagnosed or not diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, what type of support may have not availed itself to these families before the Child Health and Development Institute developed this pilot and really got out there to help pediatricians understand and begin adopting all of the current guidelines?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can tell you I think the piece of our training that's making one of the biggest impacts is that the providers are learning about the Connecticut Family Support Network. They're a wonderful organization in Connecticut. It's been around for a while, and their sole purpose is to help and advocate for families of children with special health care needs, which when a child is diagnosed with ADHD, they do become a child with special health care needs. So that has been huge because now the physicians have a connection. They have a referral that they can make. Not that they need a written referral or a prescription, but they can say, hey, go to Connecticut Family Support Network. They will help you. They will set you up with resources, and they will talk to you at any time. So I think that's been a huge piece for this project.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Early identification and age-appropriate treatment of pediatric ADHD is critical to a child's lifelong health, academic success, social competency, and mental health, as we've heard from our guest this morning, Susan McCary, who was is a primary player and a senior associate for health initiatives with the Child Health and Development Institute. Their latest issue brief addresses how pediatric primary care providers can help children diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder achieve improved health, educational, and social outcomes by fully implementing guidelines that have been updated as recently as 2011 through the American Academy of Pediatrics. We want to thank you, Susan, for helping educate me and our listeners this morning about this important development and the great pilot program, one of just a few in the country that is being a grant underwritten and maybe re-upped again. We'll look forward to following up with you on this maybe come summertime, especially if it's going to continue. So thanks for being with us today. All right. Well, if you have just landed from another dimension, today is Super Bowl Sunday. The long-awaited game of the year is here. And whether or not your team is going to take home the Lombardi Trophy, one thing holds true. There's going to be a lot of cheering and some tears and a whole lot of food. But while enjoying some of the great food that's going to be served up at Super Bowl parties at homes and at restaurants and other establishments across the state of Connecticut, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service wants to remind fans not to let foodborne illness sideline them once the game is over. And have we got the right person to talk to? Marianne Gravely is on the line. She is a 27-year meat and poultry hotline veteran and technical information specialist with the USDA and their agency's Food Safety and Inspection Service Office of Public Affairs and Consumer Education. As a matter of fact, if you've ever called their Thanksgiving turkey line, maybe you've even talked to Mary Ann before I have here in Connecticut, because she's been at this several generations long in her career with the USDA. So let's dig right in, Mary Ann. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, John. Thank you.
This is very exciting. I appreciate you kind of coming on late, a little bit later than we were planning. So thank you. So first of all, let's talk about, from 10,000 feet, how prevalent are foodborne illnesses? And do you really see huge spikes of foodborne illness manifestation in the hours and days following an event like the Super Bowl?
Well, the Centers for Disease Control estimates there are 48 million cases of foodborne illness every year in the U.S., and the Super Bowl is the second biggest food event of the year, second only to Thanksgiving. So although we don't have any specific links to the Super Bowl and foodborne illness, you have a situation where people who maybe don't do a lot of cooking are cooking, people are entertaining, people are bringing food to other people's parties. And you may have noticed this, but a Super Bowl is really long. So the food is sitting out for hours, which is a good opportunity to give food poisoning bacteria a chance to grow. So it's just another opportunity for us to talk to people about foodborne illness so that everybody can have a safe Super Bowl party.
Yeah. And as I was reporting on this earlier this week for another source, it was brought to my attention that, you know, kind of with the spike in the dangers associated with the flu season, one of the most important things that everybody, host or guest, can do to ensure that they're both keeping as clean as possible in terms of communicating foodborne illness, but also the flu, is to wash their hands. So this is an even broader universal requirement this Super Bowl Sunday.
Well, that's right. You know, at USDA, we have four steps for food safety: clean, separate, cook, and chill. But clean is number one. So you always want to start out with clean hands. You want to have the area where you're serving the food clean. If you have guests bringing food in for your party, as you're directing them over to where they can put the food, you might also direct them over to the sink, let them wash their hands first before they start opening up their dish and, you know, getting it ready for everybody. Some people are even putting hand sanitizer or wipes at the buffet table because, you know, people are going back and forth. They're serving themselves. You want to make it really easy for people to serve themselves without, you know, cross-contaminating the other food that's on the table.
Mm-hmm. So I guess one of the main universal staples of Super Bowl Sunday, it seems to be, we're way past the chips and dip stage. We've got people doing a lot of different creative things with chicken, particularly chicken wings. So this is a particular area of concern.
Well, absolutely. You know, even if you have something as simple as a cold cut tray, it can be hard to serve that, you know. So put some thought into what kind of serving utensils you're going to use. If you are having chips and dip or Chex Mix or something, have some kind of mug that, you know, people can use to scoop those up and put them on their plate so they're not just putting their hands all over the food.
Maybe, kind of like people have their red Solo cup for their beverage. They can also have a companion cup to keep their chips and Chex Mix and stuff in, so that
right.
They don't have to grab it.
In team colors.
Yes, there you go. So there's something called the danger zone that I understand you want to help people understand in terms of temperatures of holding food and cooking and storing food.
Right. The danger zone is the temperature range between 40 and 140 degrees, and that's the temperature where food poisoning bacteria grow most quickly. In fact, they double their numbers every 20 minutes. So along with the danger zone, we have the two-hour rule. You don't want food to sit in the danger zone for more than 2 hours. So, you know, if you have hot foods, ideally you would have a warming tray, a slow cooker, a chafing dish to keep those foods hot. But if you don't, just make sure they're not sitting out on your table for more than 2 hours at room temperature. I mean, they'll taste better if they're served hot anyway. But if you have a lot of chicken wings, you know, we know that 1.3 billion chicken wings are going to be consumed this Sunday, and you don't have any way to keep them hot, put a small amount on the table, keep the rest in the oven, and then periodically just, you know, bring out a new batch for the table so that your guests are always getting nice hot food.
Mm-hmm. How about with condiments, Marianne? They have a lot of, typically a lot of preservatives in them. Are condiments absolved from that 2 hour rule? Can they stay out longer? Maybe not at a hot summer picnic in direct sunlight, but you know, in somebody's living room or dining room while a Super Bowl party's going on.
Sure. For the most part, condiments don't require refrigeration for safety. You know, when you go out to eat to a hamburger place, they have ketchup and mustard just sitting on the table. They're safe at room temperature. It's just that they last longer if you keep them refrigerated. But with condiments, again, you want to give a thought to serving so that you don't have any cross-contamination happening with them.
Okay. So when it comes to some of the mainstays of a Super Bowl party, things like wings and pizza, you definitely want to watch the temperature and not serve them initially after they've thawed to room or cooled to room temperature.
You know, if you're having something delivered, whether it be pizza or wings, have your oven already hot. So if you're not ready to put it out, it can go in the oven and stay hot. Pizza does not have magical properties. It can't sit out indefinitely. It can't sit out overnight. So you either want to keep it hot or you want to finish it off and put it in the refrigerator. You don't want the pizza sitting out all evening. So, you know, you might need to put some of them in the oven and just put a small amount out at a time.
Mm-hmm. How about cold foods, things like, you know, dips or salad trays or shrimp cocktail and, you know, like cold seafoods or even sushi and things like that? Let's talk a little bit about the opposite side of the temperature spectrum.
You know, if you are planning a party, one thing you want to do is clean out your refrigerator because all those foods take up a lot of space, and you want to have room in the refrigerator to keep them cold. Even in Connecticut, it's not cold enough to store the food outside or in the garage or on the back porch. You know, we hear stories here. So because the cold food shouldn't be out for more than 2 hours either, you could either, you know, put some things like if you have a bowl of shrimp, put it in a larger bowl full of ice to keep it cold, or keep the majority of the food in the refrigerator and just periodically replenish the food onto the table. So only a small amount is out and nothing sitting out for more than 2 hours.
Okay. For a lot of folks that really kind of make Super Bowl and maybe the November or December holidays their big food gathering moments, they may not think about things like cross-contamination, but this is a particular problem, especially for folks that might be hosting in apartments or places with smaller kitchens where there's very limited counter space for them to do prep.
Well, that's right. If you don't have room in your refrigerator, you know, you could use a cooler with ice to keep things cold. And in fact, you might want to designate the cooler or, you know, even a box full of ice. You can line a cardboard box with a trash bag, put ice in it, keep the beer in that, and save the refrigerator for your food, because it's most important that the food that you're serving to people is cold.
Very good. And lastly, I guess, you know, while some would argue who the most important players are on the teams that are going to be playing in the Super Bowl today, one of the most important things that everybody's home team is going to need if they're doing food prep is a food thermometer.
Absolutely. The only way you can really know that a food has been cooked to a safe temperature is to use a food thermometer. You can't tell by looking at something if it's been cooked properly. If you are cooking meatballs, you want to cook them to 160. If you're cooking chicken wings or any kind of poultry at all, cook it to 165. Your casseroles and dips, they also go to 165 if they're being heated. And once they're cooked, then you can keep them in the oven, keep them warm, make sure they stay above 140 degrees. But that way you know they're at a safe temperature for your guests.
Excellent. Well, our guest, Marianne Gravely, has been with the USDA Meat and Poultry Hotline for 27 years. She knows what she's talking about. She's also a technical information specialist in the agency's Food Safety and Inspection Service Office of Public Affairs and Consumer Education. She did a great job sandwiching a bunch of consumer education in for us here as we wrap up our Super Bowl Sunday for the People program. Marianne, it was a great pleasure to speak with you this morning. You know, as excitement for this year's Super Bowl grows, the U.S. Department of Agriculture encourages consumers to use safe food handling practices and avoid becoming one of the estimated 48 million Americans, including many hundreds of thousands who are going to end up in hospitals from foodborne illnesses after the game. I hope you'll take well to her advice on the program this morning. And Marianne, it was great to meet you and make your acquaintance. Thank you so much for your service and for your help with us this morning. And don't forget, if you didn't get any specific points of this information this morning, you can just go on your phone or computer and go to askkaren.gov. That's askkaren.gov to get more information. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.